Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, experts warn us that life in our oceans is facing mass extinction. Is there still time to prevent the die-off? But first, with climate change upon us, the Earth is changing the way it functions. What exactly is occurring and where are we headed? Scientists say the Earth is changing more rapidly than we have expected. Ecosystems are shifting and some species are dying out. What does this mean for humanity? Larry Schweiger is with us. Larry Schweiger is the president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation and the author of Last Chance, Preserving Life on Earth. Welcome, Larry Schweiger.
Good to be here.
It's great to have you here. I think you said something like 37% of species would be extinct by 2050.
50.
Is that still happening?
We're still on course for continued extinctions. In fact, the latest I've seen is 40 to 70% of the species, according to the path that we're currently on.
By 2050?
Well, it's by the end of the century, they'll be on the road to extinction is the way I characterize it in the book. And that pattern is continuing. And because we're adding more carbon to the atmosphere today than we were then, almost nearly double what we're putting in the air, the speed of this is picking up, and that's has everybody alarmed. Instead of reducing carbon emissions, we're increasing carbon emissions.
Now, one of the things that struck me was that the IPCC said that even though our economics were in decline, that the carbon has, what, doubled since 2000?
Because of what's happening, particularly in China, China has just blown right by the United States in terms of carbon emissions. But we all need to remember that they're making products for us. Our industry has unfortunately moved to China, and they are making manufacturing products largely for America and for South America and elsewhere. But we're the largest customer that they have. You know, we're still contributing to that problem.
So let's talk about that then a little bit. I know that part of the problem with China is coal. And mm-hmm. I know we have something like 1,000 coal plants that are on track to be built now. I mean, that's like what's coming, the new coal plants. A lot of those are in China.
Yeah, it's really sad that we're continuing to build coal plants anywhere in the world. It doesn't make sense. The World Bank finally has decided it's not going to be funding coal plants anymore. But it's not a prudent investment. We're making these investments. They're going to be around for 30 to 50 years, and they're going to be polluting at a very, very high level. The Earth just simply cannot afford to have that kind of carbon pollution.
Now, you say it's not a good investment. Of course, it's not a good investment environmentally, but it's cheap. Isn't that why you see them in going up in the countries such as India and China?
I also think it's bad economic investment because the world is heading to a very disrupted climate. And as that becomes increasingly painful and more clear, they're going to have to wean themselves off of those dirty coal plants. And in my view, the best thing we should be doing right now is investing in wind, solar, efficiency, and a lot of other renewable energy technologies to get us off of this dependence on dirty fuels.
I would like to get into some of that. And I know that there has been quite a bit of movement in some of the cities, like Los Angeles is really getting more and more involved in solar. But let's go back to your book, because you've broken this down in a way that's kind of interesting. There's one chapter where you say victims, perpetrators, and enablers. So let's talk about, first of all, one of the perpetrators you said was really these invasive species, which are getting worse because of climate change. Can you help us understand where it's happening and what are these invasive species and how is it connected to climate?
Well, first of all, when you change the climate, you alter the ecosystems. You can't save an ecosystem unless you save the sky over the ecosystem. So as these systems warm up and change, dry out, other species begin to move in as the original species disappear. And we're seeing that pattern. Rivers, for example, are overheating. So we're losing our cold water fisheries. They're being replaced with warm water fisheries. And in some cases, with invasive species from other continents that are finding their way into these habitats. So endangered species, threatened species, and invasive species all are altered by the changing climate. And unfortunately for the endangered species, it's most often that they disappear.
Can you give us some other examples of ecosystems in which there would be an endangered species that's being threatened by an invasive one?
The one that comes quickly to mind is what's happening to our oceans. We're acidifying our oceans. And so if you're a shellfish or a finfish or phytoplankton, for that matter, you need to use calcium in order to thrive, in order to prosper. And so as these systems are being altered with acidic waters, coral reefs, for example, are in decline in a number of places because of high temperatures as well as high acidity. So that's an example of an entire ocean system that's being stressed.
And the coral reefs, of course, that's a bit of a double whammy because they're like forests. They're supposedly like the lungs of the ocean.
Exactly.
So then it makes the climate worse.
And on the terrestrial side, what's happening to moose is really a good indicator. Moose are disappearing from places like New Hampshire and parts of Maine and New England. And also they've collapsed in Minnesota. The Minnesota moose population has dropped 60% because moose are a cold weather species. And as insects move in, particularly ticks, it takes a big toll on the moose. And we've seen those declines on the southern border of the moose populations.
I think it was also in the IPCC report talking about how so many animals that are cold water animals and other species are moving more and more to the north. But then there are some that really just don't have anywhere to go.
Exactly. That's true on mountains, too. The species that live in high mountain systems are being pushed further and further up the mountain and eventually will not have a place to go. You know, interestingly, Rachel Carson back in 1950 detailed the changing patterns of wildlife and plants and fisheries and birds. She saw climate change because she saw wildlife moving further north and further south on the planet and also further in the oceans, further north. So wildlife have been a great indicator of climate change for a long time. We just haven't been listening to them.
That was back in 1950. That's right. His articles in the Guardian, I believe it was talking about just things like butterflies that would normally be common in somewhere like Britain, gone from there and moved onward. And then the animals like the polar bears. Mm-hmm. You've talked about them in the book. They're not the only ones, of course, that need the Arctic ice to survive.
Well, I visited Churchill last winter and saw the bears. And bears are losing weight year by year because there's not enough ice for them to get out and feed. So they delay their access to the ice, which is where they really get their food. And they scratch around for food on shore, but they don't get very much. And they really need the ice.
How thin is the ice now? I mean, is it just all but disappeared?
The ice has contracted quite substantially. There's great graphs that show that. Last year, it bounced back a little bit, and everybody got all excited about it. But it's truly on a downward path. And there's one study that suggested we have an 80% chance of being ice-free in the Arctic by 2030. We just watch it year by year, and you can see it shrinking away. And that's incidentally altering the weather patterns. You know, this polar vortex that we've experienced in the east, it's made it colder. Here in California, it's made it drier. But clearly, we're in a pattern that is not typical because the Arctic ice is rapidly disappearing.
The droughts are also changing ecosystems considerably, and you're seeing a lot of wildlife moving closer and closer to the cities.
Exactly. I think one of the most troubling trends is the number of very large forest fires. The number of large forest fires in the West has doubled in the last decade. And the Forest Service is predicting yet another doubling of the forest fires. Last year, they spent half of their entire budget fighting forest fires. So here's an agency charged with managing the forest, and they're spending half of their money just simply fighting fires. And, of course, we lost 19 firemen, forest firefighters, last year in Arizona. So these fires are hotter. And the other important thing about them is that they're burning the soil up. They're so hot that the soil, the humus in the soil gets burnt out. And therefore, it's very, very hard to recover those forests once they've burnt that hot.
When the soil burns, then all of the...
All the seeds are gone. All the organic matter is gone. So you have mineral
soil. So all the life that was in the soil is killed.
And that's what happens when you have these super fires like that. And that's what we're seeing more of.
And then the animals, of course, come into the city. Like we had our famous bear here. I don't know if you followed our bear, Glenn Berrien. Is that happening in other cities as well with these animals moving in increasingly?
Wildlife are opportunists. And if they lose their original habitat, they're going to go searching for other habitats. And we're seeing that. I don't know the particular story of this bear. I heard about it, but I don't know what drove him to the city. But You know, young males will often move into a city as they're looking for some new territory. In the bear population, they tend to be the roamer.
Climate change is bringing about invasive species. What else?
On the good side, people are starting to understand that the system is more fragile. I think there's a growing understanding that our weather patterns are out of whack and that we've seen increasing storms. So I'm hopeful, personally, that we're going to see some political change. I think it's short term. It's looking ugly in Washington because the attitudes, particularly the Republican House members, is to do nothing. And I think that's going to catch up to them. They're on the wrong side of history. So I'm trying to hang on to hope on that. And I think that there's a growing number of businesses that see the need to put a price on carbon and to start shifting the energy production towards a clean energy source.
Do we see more of an industry coming up with the clean energy sources that we were talking about earlier, wind, solar?
Absolutely. I spoke at a forum in San Francisco at Oakland, and a young man came up to me. He's a student there, but he's starting a company to retrofit buildings with efficient light systems. And, you know, he and his buddies have about 30 employees now, and he's a college student. So I think there's a lot of really cool innovation going on, and certainly there's a number of companies that are doing well. I think Tesla has done extraordinarily well, has surpassed most people's understandings. SolarCity, First Solar, the wind industry itself has done extraordinarily well. They have unfortunately banged into a limit on their tax program that we have to accelerate the investment in wind. But we're hoping that we'll get that restored this year and more importantly, get a price on carbon.
So let's talk about a couple of these. You mentioned Tesla. I assume most people know about Tesla. But for those who don't, this is an electric car that has been named the best car. It's the safest. It's the best running car.
The idea of having electric cars is that the motors on electric cars are very clean. They last a long time. They have high acceleration, tremendous control. They give you a fantastic ride. And the charging stations they're establishing all over the country, it's going to be a transformative technology. It's going to change the way we think about cars. They can be driven on wind and solar.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar's Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. We're speaking with Larry Schweiger, and he's the president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation and the author of Last Chance, Preserving Life on Earth. Let's go to some of these policies that you're hopeful about.
Yeah.
We've not seen very much movement so far, not with the international community and not here in the U.S., because as you mentioned, we've had a lot of representatives that don't understand the climate issue. What kind of movement have you seen that gives you some sense that there will be policies?
I'm hopeful that the American public is going to drive this change. I don't put a lot of hope in the politicians getting there on their own. They don't understand it because they don't want to understand it. You know, if you look at where the money's coming from for elections, the incumbent industries, coal, gas, oil, are pumping a lot of money into these elections. And others, like the Koch brothers, putting enormous amounts of money into elections. And they also put an enormous amount of money into our media. So they have a real lockhold on politics and on media. But I think eventually the American public's going to figure out that we have a very serious problem. And I think it's starting to show through in a pretty dramatic way. I've been seeing more and more indications that people are getting that our climate system is being disrupted. And when you look at what's happening to California, for example, and the impact that it has on the food supplies of the country, we're seeing the same thing in Arizona and New Mexico and parts of Texas. And we're seeing these huge forest fires and tremendous storm events, what happened in Colorado last year, what happened in New York City. People are starting to connect the dots. And at some point, there's going to be a moment when they do not tolerate politicians who are pretending that this is not a problem.
You know, one of the things that I watch is when politicians put forward policies that they think will be popular, but they don't really do very much. They're sort of symbolic. And that's one of the things I fear. Even if, say, the majority come on board to put forward a climate bill, what will it really contain in it that is meaningful?
It's an interesting point. The climate bill that we moved through the House at the leadership of Nancy Pelosi, frankly, was a bill that had issues, but it was actually going to cut carbon emissions over time by 80%. And we got that bill to the Senate and installed that, you know, Senator Ted Kennedy's death replaced by Senator Braun. And we lost, you know, the majority that we needed in order to pass a bill in the Senate. And so that bill died. But I think it's going to come back. There's a growing need or feeling a need. Even the senators themselves did an overnight filibuster recently where they talked all night. They literally stayed up all night talking about climate change. It was symbolic, but it was an indication that they're starting to see the pressures mounting and they're willing to stand up and talk about it. And I think you're going to see that more and more. And I think, as I said earlier, these shifts occur very quickly. You know, one day, you know, you can get away with saying stupid things about climate change, and the next day it catches up to you. I see that coming. I have hope that that will happen.
You mentioned the media just now. You also talked about it quite a bit in your book and about really how superficial the United States media have been and in its own way misinforming people about the climate issue. You know, we get an IPCC report and then they cover it. Al Gore comes out with his movie and they cover it and people start to understand things, but then you have ClimateGate. ClimateGate happens and then everybody goes, oh, science, you know, science is all rigged. So I wonder, when we think about informing people, you think they're connecting the dots. How are they managing to do this?
My personal view is that it's more through the social networks. It's more through organizing it on campuses. It's more through...
So it's the younger people.
So it's younger people primarily, but we're also seeing increasing numbers of women starting to understand that their kids' future is at risk, the things that they really love and care for. And so I think there's a loving leadership that's emerging, and I think you'll see more and more women stepping up. I also believe that the politicians are really reflecting what's currently happening, and they don't have a real long field of vision. They look to the next election. And I think they're hoping that they get by on the next election by telling a false story about climate change. And I think a few important elections can turn that around, where people reject a lawmaker because he or she has been on the wrong side of climate change. And I think a few of those kind of turning points will wake the others up.
That'll be interesting to see. One of the things that you wrote about in the book was about how mass media have been really trivializing American life and American politics, and that has created more problems with people understanding the environment and what's really going on with the issues. What is going on behind the scenes of the media that you think is leading to this?
The media at one point in time was required to create content that met a test called the Fairness Doctrine. Today, they no longer are required to do that. So we've seen a decline, I think a very rapid decline in the overall content on media. And a good example for me is what I witnessed in the Gulf oil spill. There were a number of camera crews down there interviewing BP employees and a few watermen who were not able to fish. And I went around and asked them if they were out on the water, had they actually seen the spill, even though they're only 8-10 miles from some of the oil. They hadn't seen it. And the reason for it was that their companies wouldn't hire the boats to go out onto the water. And so we hired the vessels to take them out onto the water and showed them the damage that was being done. Every day we took the various camera crews out. And so most of what people saw on television was shot off of boats that we had rented so that the media could see the event.
So had you not done that, you, the leader of a nonprofit organization, all that people would have gotten would have been interviews with BP.
Talking heads. And BP footage, which is the other thing that happens. You know, BP flies at 30,000 feet and flies over the spill and says everything's under control. And that's the image that they were striving to achieve. We were effective, and so effective that BP hired a new media firm to come in and actually then paid all the watermen 6 months in advance and gave them a contract that was double what we could pay them. Plus, they paid for their gasoline every day. So they basically bought the boats off the water, and that's why the media stopped covering the spill. The spill was still going on. We just couldn't access boats because they had been hired away by BP, and they were having the boat captain sit on the docks. They were paying them to sit on the docks.
A couple things I can draw from this. One is that journalists didn't have the company support to actually go do a good job.
Right.
But the other thing might have been even a little bit of, you know, it's too much trouble.
You know, the really sad thing today is we see it over and over again. Journalism is no longer what it once was. Before, you had crews that were out on the scene actually witnessing and recording, you know, what was taking place. Today, you're lucky to get talking heads. And it's the same talking heads, you know, every hour. It's the same people. And they are experts at all different things. They just hire them in to talk. And the people are not getting, in my view, an unvarnished sense of what's happening in our world.
And certainly no context to help them understand how it's all put together. There was a bit of talk about carbon removal from the atmosphere. Do you think that's a viable option?
The best carbon removal system we have is trees.
Which are also dying.
Which are dying, but we need to be planting trees. We also need to be using winter cover crops on our soils. When the pioneers settled in the United States, they turned over soil and it was black. It was black because it was carbon. That was carbon in the soil. 50% of the organic matter is carbon. And what happened was they mismanaged the soil and burnt the carbon out of the soil. 20% of the carbon that we have in the air right now, the human-caused carbon, is from our soils. So as we grow cover crops and do other things, we can restore that carbon year by year, and we need to do that. So I think the best carbon capturing devices are actually trees and soils.
What about diet? Some people are saying that the meat industry generates 15-20% of the emissions as well.
What we ought to be looking at is these feedlots, these concentrated animal operations where animals are put into enclosed systems where the waste accumulates, vents a lot of methane, causes a lot of other water pollution problems. And we really ought to be looking at our food system.
So if you were going to advise everybody listening to us right now, top five things you could do to make a difference.
Well, I think the first thing to do is look at your own home. And there are a number of things that we can do. I encourage people to produce their own food. You know, that's a very low energy input for food. I have a garden at home that I use compost in, and it's an important part of how I live. Change out your light bulbs. Don't even stop at fluorescent. Go right to LEDs. Reduce your own carbon usage. If you can afford a new car, I would get either a hybrid or if you can afford it, get an electric car. Or take mass transportation, live in urban areas. I mean, there's a lot of things that we can do in our own home. But I also think Americans need to take back America. You know, democracy does not function without the active participation of the voters. Ben Franklin, on his way out of the Independence Hall, was stopped, and a woman asked him, she said, "Sir, I understand you created a republic in there." And he said, "Yes, ma'am, we did, and it's yours if you can keep it."
Yes, I remember that.
And we're not keeping it very well. We're not doing our jobs. We need to hold ourselves accountable as voters, to be informed, to understand what these people are doing. And it's very destructive. There's voter suppression going on now. There's a manipulation of voting districts so that people, you know, are basically carved out of the system. There's all sorts of things that are happening. We should demand that they change that behavior. And there are people who are clearly being oppressed by the bad politics that we're seeing. And so I see climate as one of those big fights that we must win. We hope we win. This is a must win for our children and for their children.
Well, thank you so much, Larry Schweiger.
Thank you.
The book is called Last Chance, Preserving Life on Earth. He is president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation. Thank you so much for
being
with us.
It's great to be here.
Up next, how to avert a mass extinction in our oceans. Coming up next, stay tuned. Listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Scientists warn of a possible mass extinction in our oceans, with far-reaching consequences for human life as well. But they add that it's not too late to address it. What exactly is happening to life in the oceans, and what can be done to avert a mass die-off? Three experts join us. Robert Warner is a professor of marine biology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Mary Sewell also joins us. She is a professor of biological sciences at the University of Auckland. And Stephen Palumbi is a professor of marine sciences and director at Stanford University's Hopkins Marine Station. Palumbi is also the author of The Evolution Explosion, How Humans Cause Rapid Evolutionary Change, and The Extreme Life of the Sea. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the three of you here. I wanted to start with this study that Bob Warner, you and Steve Palumbi both worked on that dealt with defaunation in the oceans. And I think where I want you to start, for those of us who are not as familiar with the concept, what exactly does this mean and how is it distinct from extinction and other types of wildlife losses? Steve Palumbi, can you help us understand that?
The word defaunation, you're absolutely right, is not in general use. And we struggled a lot to find a better one. It means taking animal life out of the ocean. And we couldn't find a better term than that. It's odd because we're doing it an awful lot, taking animal life out of the ocean, from fish that are coming out to corals that are being damaged from all kinds of different reasons. And it's a general term that reflects how we're affecting the ocean in a large number of ways. And it's different than extinction, because extinction you can think of as the very, very last step in defaunation. The minute that the last individual of that species is gone, it's extinct. Before that, it is not extinct. But before that, we might have been taking it out of the ocean to such an extent that we're having big effects on the ocean, even before extinction.
Bob Warner.
One of the reasons that we used that term defaunation was that it has been used to describe loss of animals on land. And we wanted to make a parallel. In fact, that was one of the major objectives of this study, was to make a parallel between what has happened on land, that is, first defaunation and then eventual extinction, and compare that to what's happening in the ocean. See if there are parallels, historical lessons that we could bring out. And it's a easy parallel to make, except that it's shifted much where the oceans are not where the land is now. And that was a major part of the story.
So what exactly does that mean? How different are they? What were the findings in the differences?
Well, in the past few hundred years on land, there have been probably well over 500 extinctions that can be attributed to human activity. And in the ocean, a careful search reveals only about 15. That doesn't sound like very many. But on the other hand, the progress of defaunation, that is, the loss of animals down to levels where they really aren't doing much in the way of functioning within ecosystems in the ocean, has been proceeding quite rapidly. So this paper was somewhat of a warning that we don't necessarily want to go down the same road that we took on land.
Mary Sewell, you've specialized in certain kinds of creatures in the ocean. Is there some of your findings that also fit into their findings?
Not completely. Most of my work is actually on echinoderms, which are like sea urchins and starfish and things. And they are not subject to the same levels of defaunation because very few people eat them. Though saying that, the sea cucumbers are endangered or threatened in many parts, Indo-Pacific, because they are a very important Asian food source. So they probably would be a good example of a species which has been fished to the verge of extinction, but not quite yet.
Is fishing, overfishing, one of the primary means of this defaunation? Steve Palumbi?
We are looking at overfishing being a primary source of that kind of defaunation, exactly. And following up on what Bob was saying, we can kind of get an idea what the history of fishing has been like. And when we look at it, we see that industrial level fishing, what we're doing now, is really a pretty recent invention. 200 years ago, people were fishing all over the world, but they were using sail-driven ships and hempen ropes and a lot lower technology. Now we're using factory ships that are driven by amazing diesel engines. They can go all over the world. They can fish every part of the ocean very, very heavily. And that's just happened over the last 100, 150 years or so. So that ramping up of the new industrial revolution in the ocean is one of the things that the paper is about. It also also, though, projects a little bit forward in that overfishing is a very serious problem, but it's not the only problem. And then as we ramp up the industrial use of the oceans, then we see more and more parts of the ocean that are being affected by things like habitat destruction, pollution, all the things that industrialization has done on land are happening at a greater and greater and greater pace in the ocean.
Bob Werner.
The parallels with what happened on land are really striking. We call it fishing, but it's commercial hunting. Commercial hunting used to be a big deal on land. And before that, it was unrestricted hunting. And after that was habitat modification, changing the land. And then finally, the Industrial Revolution, which sort of put the icing on the cake. And we saw extinctions happening due to each and every one of these activities. We're still very actively hunting commercially in the ocean. And as Steve points out, the next two things that we're worried about the most are habitat modification, changing especially the coastal areas through development of ports, through aquaculture, through all these different activities. And then finally, the industrialization, not just of fishing, but industrialization of use of the ocean, mining, shipping, a whole vast array of things that now have, as Steve said, global impact. And we are a little bit fearful that we're on the verge of seeing the same sort of patterns that we saw on land happen in the ocean.
Mary Sewell, what about the acidification? This is something you've looked at. What's the impact of that on wildlife and the oceans in general, the ecosystems?
Ocean acidification is a global phenomenon because it's caused by increased CO2 in the atmosphere and that dissolves in the ocean. And what we've seen is that we've got large impacts on any organisms that have a shell, so any organisms that calcify, but also it affects lots of other things like fish and organisms that are really important for food. For example, oysters are a huge source of food for parts of Asia, and that the species that they feed on is particularly affected by ocean acidification. So ocean acidification, because it is a global phenomena and is not easily remediated, can have massive flow-on effects to food security and affecting the aquaculture industry particularly.
And what's causing the acidification?
It's just chemistry. It's been known since the 1700s. You know, when you dissolve CO2 in water, it forms this acid called carbonic acid. And we're all familiar with it. If you drink a carbonated beverage or a beer or something a little bit too quickly and you have a burp, you get that kind of little metal taste in your mouth. Well, that's what carbonic acid is. And that's what's changing the pH of the ocean.
And so the carbon dioxide that we're getting into the ocean, is this completely a result of climate change or are there other factors?
Well, CO2 is coming into the ocean mainly through the atmosphere. So the atmospheric CO2 just dissolves into the ocean. But there are other sources that come in from things like manufacturing cement and all sorts of other things, industrial.
If we have the acidification on one side and then we have overfishing on the other, give us a sort of 101 ecology here about how impacting one of these species might then impact the rest of it. Steve Palumbi?
A good way to think about the impacts of ocean life is within their ecosystem. And say an example that Mary brought up is echinoderms, sea urchins. And we know that if you fish sea urchins too much, then they drop out of the population and there's a lot fewer of them. What do sea urchins actually do? They eat algae. And if you take away all the sea urchins, then algae can bloom up all around. So coral reefs, for example, when sea urchins in the Caribbean died off in the 1980s, that resulted in an enormous algal bloom that outcompeted many of the corals that people were even studying at the very time. And it led to a shift in coral reefs all around the Caribbean. It turns out that that particular problem with sea urchins was in parallel made worse by the fact that we were also overfishing the fish on those Caribbean reefs, many of which are herbivores that also eat algae. So that's a pretty well-known example in marine circles about how changing one part of the ecosystem has ripple effects into other parts of the ecosystem.
Bob Werner?
It's important to think that every one of these organisms that we're worried about, the ones that are being overfished, the ones that are being affected by habitat modification, the ones, as Mary said, that are being affected by acidification, are part of food webs, are part of an ecosystem. And as we defaunate, as we remove them in any sort of significant numbers from the environment, the effects that they used to have aren't there anymore. And as Steve pointed out, sometimes a missing piece in an ecosystem can change it radically such that it doesn't look like it did before. And that's one of our worries in terms of defaunation, is that half the time we don't even know what role these very large and often very important organisms had in the ecosystems. We don't know what their role was, and we've already removed them. So that it's not just the loss of one species or another. When we lost 500 species on land, it wasn't just losing 500 species, it was losing key players in lots of different ecosystems. And that's, I think, something that we've only recently begun to appreciate, is that it's not just the organism, it's the ecology and it's the ecosystem.
Mary Sewell.
One of the examples that I use in my teaching is, of course, the Stella sea cow, which was a very large organism that was hunted to extinction in Alaska by Russian sea otter hunters, and is estimated that it ate 1 ton of kelp every single day. So here we have the sea urchins eating the kelp on the bottom, and then we had this sea cow, huge sea cow, eating all the kelp from the surface. Now, it's hard to imagine if you have a large population of these sea cows each eating a ton of kelp a day, that would make a huge impact to the ecosystem. And so what we're studying now is obviously the ecosystem without that sea cow. And so, as Bob says, we can't really know what impact that had on the ecosystem because we've lost it.
Could I jump in there for a second?
Yes,
that's
please.
A great example. And the other aspect of this is that extinction, like the stellar sea cow, is forever. And we can't know what it was doing because it's gone. But a lot of marine organisms are not quite yet extinct, but they have been depleted to such an extent that their ecological role is imperiled. And in the paper, we actually define a couple different kinds of extinction. And that might seem silly. Maybe it's like defining a couple different kinds of dead. But in fact, you can be much lowered in abundance and not play your ecological role. That's what we call ecological extinction. A good example of that is in the same ecosystem that Mary was talking about, the northern kelp forests, North Pacific and along the Alaska and California and Canadian coasts. There, sea otters were hunted to near extinction, so much that their ecological role they were no longer able to play. But the difference there was the southern sea otter and the Alaska sea otter wasn't extinct. And by careful management, those populations could be brought back, at least in some areas, and we could see them play their ecological role again.
Steve Palumbi, I wanted to ask you about something else that might be related, and I wanted to see if this was connected in somehow. And it has to do with the book that you wrote about how humans are causing a more rapid evolutionary process. Is this all connected?
It is connected. That book is called The Evolution Explosion, and it was about the rapid ecological change that people are creating all over the world by changing the land and in fact, the sea. What we find is that when we change the ecology, then natural populations, they respond. Sometimes they respond by going extinct. Others respond by actually evolving. We see that a lot more commonly in organisms that we think of not so fondly, diseases and weeds in particular, which have evolved very quickly to match our new urban landscapes, for example, for weeds. But we also see it in fish populations. If we fish salmon very, very hard, we take a lot of the adults out, then what we tend to select for are salmon that grow more slowly and they grow more skinny so they can fit through the nets. That kind of evolutionary response to the ecological change that we're seeing is, in fact, they're predicted by all manner of ecological and evolutionary theory. And the fact that we are actually having such a strong ecological effect on all kinds of ecosystems is reflected in the rapid evolution by these species when they can respond in a way that's beneficial to them.
One of the things in this study was that we are changing virtually all marine systems, but that implies that there are some that we are not changing, or was that just that we have not checked them all? Bob Werner, what do you say?
Well, there's some that are effectively insulated from a lot of our activity, and that's the very deep sea on the bottom. Probably not as many changes happening there as are happening elsewhere, but the biggest changes are happening in the places that we affect the most, and that's the coastal oceans. And there is no coastal ocean where most of the productivity occurs, where most of the fishing occurs. There is no place in the coastal ocean that hasn't been affected by human beings. There is something that we need to remember, though, and many of the studies that Steve has talked about and Mary has talked about are showing that, is that we know how things work much better than we did long ago, and that we don't necessarily have to follow this the same path of extinction and huge changes that occurred on land. We know that those changes occurred, and interestingly enough, now we know pretty much why they occurred and what the consequences were. And we have the tools now to address that, which we did not have during all of the occurrences on land. We know ecology now. We know how fisheries work. We know the effects that humans can have. And we have the tools, in other words. We have the history. And now what we really need, I think, is the will to use those tools.
Mary Sewell, anything you'd like to add to that?
There's been quite a push both from the scientific community and more broadly to actually put a marine protected area in the Ross Sea, which is one of the last areas on Earth that hasn't been impacted by fishing. And this was The Last Ocean was a movie and is also an advocacy group trying to get some protection in that area, which hasn't been impacted so much by fishing, though it's being subject to fishing at the moment. So there are some areas in the poles particularly that are less affected by humans, but as a result of climate change, those are again becoming more open, especially in the Arctic, where you now have the possibility of oil rigs and fishing going on in the Arctic with the opening of the Northwest Passage.
If we were to look at the patterns over time, is it more rapid, these changes, or are they going at a particular pace? Are we at a point where we should be completely alarmed? Steve Palumbi, what do you think?
What we've been able to show in the paper is that the changes in the ocean lag behind the changes on land, but that they're catching up. And the technology that has been applied across the land to industrialize it and use vast stretches of land is now being used in the ocean. And you have new technologies that are popping in, like deep sea mining by autonomous robots, by using wave energy generators all along the coast, putting massive aquaculture facilities out in the open sea. All of this technology-driven development of the ocean is going on at such a pace that it means that our use of the ocean industrially is catching up hugely. One of the things that Bob had mentioned a little while ago was that while we were doing that to the land, we didn't have the tools to understand exactly what was happening, how things were connected, and maybe what to do about it. Now we can look at that, realize that we haven't done that quite to the ocean yet, and we are in a position to do things differently in the ocean than we had on land. We know some things that we should do differently. We know how to do them. And so the real onus right now is on using the ocean in an industrial way, because we are going to use the ocean that way. But to balance that use with our understanding that ocean ecosystems are what we're using, and if we destroy those ecosystems and destroy their functioning, well, then we've killed the goose that lays the golden eggs, right? And so we don't want to do that. We want to use the ocean more sensibly. That's the challenge ahead of us, how to industrialize the use of the ocean so people can take benefit of it, but keep the ocean functioning in its productivity and its diversity as much as we possibly can.
One of the other things that, Mary Sewell, you've studied, it deals with the plastics in the ocean. And I know there are these huge gyres with plastic in it, but you've also found these microplastics that come from things that we use every day. How bad of a problem is this on life in the ocean?
This is an area of growing research, and it's only been really in the last few years that people realized how much of this microplastic was getting into the ocean and have started to use smaller size plankton nets to be able to identify this. But I mean, I would say at the moment we're in the early stages of quantifying that, because it's hard to detect how much is coming out of wastewater plants. And as Bob has mentioned, we've got lots of our big cities are on the coasts, and a lot of that waste is going into the ocean. So putting a number on that microplastic aspect of the plastic pollution is actually quite difficult at this time. But in the laboratory anyway, we can show that it has very bad effects on organisms like small copepods and other members of the plankton, similar to what happens when turtles and seabirds eat larger pieces of plastic. So it's a growing area of research, so I think it's a bit premature to say that.
So one of the previous studies that I had looked at, I had read about certain marine mammals that were developing neurological disorders. Maybe something they're ingesting. Maybe it's the pollution. Bob Warner, Steve Palumbi, do one of you know about this sort of going crazy of marine mammals?
It's due to something called domoic acid, which is produced by naturally occurring phytoplankton in the ocean. But usually these phytoplankton are blooming. It's a harmful algal bloom, which comes. We're not completely sure what causes these. Usually it could be pollution, it could be warming, it could be a number of different circumstances which lead to an unprecedented reproduction of organisms that then secrete this substance, which upon ingestion, especially as it works its way up the food chain into marine mammals, can cause some neurological problems. So it's just as much of a problem in some ways as warming or acidification, in the sense of it's another example of disturbing an ecosystem to the point where we get unexpected consequences.
This is Steve Palumbi. I added just another example of that, because it actually shows some of the very unintended consequences of our industrial use of the ocean. Not only has domoic acid been studied, but the buildup of other types of pollutants, particularly in marine mammals and dolphins, like PCBs and dioxins, have been studied. And these are pollutants that build up in our bodies, too. We can't get rid of them. They're just dissolved in fat layers in mammalian bodies. They have no place to go. We can't excrete them in any way, except one, and that's that these compounds can actually dissolve in milk. And so a number of studies, just horrific, heartbreaking studies, have been done of dolphins that have built up these pollutants in their bodies. And then the first calf that a female dolphin has, and she feeds with her milk, she's just pumped a huge amount of these pollutants into her milk and into her calf. Many of the first calves die because of that. And it's just because we are making these compounds that play these very different roles in our bodies than any natural compound has had. And as a consequence, the first calf dies for many of these individuals.
Mary Sewell.
Because the small pieces of plastic in the ocean are mainly polyethylene, and they actually, they're kind of like a sponge, so they take up a lot of those PCBs and stuff in the ocean as well. So they're getting in at the smaller members of the plankton that then go up the food chain and eaten by us. A lot of the things that valuable fish, especially tuna, are being shown to have got lots of plastic derived products in them that have come up the food chain. So it's coming into our bodies as well through the fish that we eat.
So that's one example of how we're all interlinked and how humans are impacted by this very phenomenon that we're talking about with the ecosystems and the animals. What are some of the other ways that humans are impacted by what we're doing in these oceans? Mary Sewell, do you want to start?
Well, I talked a little bit about food security when we were talking about ocean acidification, and that's a really important thing. In many parts of the world, you know, 40% or more of their protein is coming from the ocean. So if we're impacting fish populations, then it makes it more difficult for people to get food or more expensive. So that's a, you know, economic and social consequence.
Steve Palumbi?
Another example to follow on Mary is the way that marine organisms and marine ecosystems actually protect our shorelines. Coral reefs are an excellent example. The average coral reef catches waves. Waves break across it, and it dissipates. It absorbs 97% of the energy of those waves as the wave goes across the reef. If it weren't for those reefs, then that wave energy would crash on the shores, our shores. It would disrupt development. It would cause an enormous amount of erosion and an enormous amount of ecological damage. The same is true of mangroves that protect shorelines all around the tropics. And the same is true of even marshes that protect temperate coastlines. So the coastlines all over the world are home to organisms that naturally grow. They repair themselves. They can keep pace with sea level rise if they're growing at their normal rate. And all of this is protecting our coastal development. And all of that is imperiled if those ecosystems don't function.
Bob Warner.
Following up on what Steve said, so all those mangroves and coral reefs are wonderful things to have around. They do help preserve the coastline and preserve our own safety. And the mirror image of that is development of the coastlines for example, aquaculture, where we're losing mangroves left and right, not because of storms, not because of warming, but because we're just ripping them up and putting in facilities for aquaculture. Aquaculture is not necessarily the next savior for food security in the world, simply because we're not necessarily doing it right, and we're certainly destroying a lot of habitat in the process. It's a very interesting parallel example to what happened on land, where we converted to aquaculture after we stopped hunting as much. And in the process of modifying all of that land, we lost a lot of animals. And the same thing can easily happen in the ocean. I think there are ways of doing aquaculture responsibly, but they might cost more and they might take some more time. But it's something that we need to think about, not just, oh, well, we could just replace fishing with raising all the fish ourselves. That's not necessarily going to happen.
We started to talk about the tools that we have to potentially stop the destruction, or at least slow the destruction, and let the ocean heal itself. Steve Palumbi, you started talking about those tools, what they might be. It sounds like a lot of it is policy oriented, perhaps some limitations, perhaps some regulatory means of how these things should be done if we're going to continue the industrial types of activities. If you were going to say what your top three that you think might be, what would you say?
The first thing is that our best partners for helping ocean ecosystems recover and thrive are actually those species in the oceans themselves. They're generally hugely productive. They have large numbers of offspring. We know from all kinds of work around the planet for decades that when we leave parts of the ocean alone, then it tends to come back. So we have the ability there to use this productivity of the ocean species themselves to help us. What I would say in terms of the policies and your top three are protecting areas. Mary mentioned marine protected areas in the Ross Sea is really probably the top one. That protecting parts of the ocean from some kinds of human use, whether it be fishing or industrial use or whatever, has been something that has been used for decades and is shown to work in many, many, many cases. Two, we know now from experiments that have been done in developed countries that we can have sustainable fisheries, that if we regulate the fisheries effort in a way that makes biological sense and sense in human economies, that we can actually achieve this wonderful goal of having fisheries and having the fish populations all at the same time. And the third one is actually, I think, looking at the way we're using the oceans in different ways, reducing conflict in use of the oceans in ways that might actually be more akin to zoning on land, and using the ocean in this way that says, okay, we know that some industrial uses of the ocean are going to prevent us from fishing there. No one goes fishing in Long Beach Harbor because it's one of the biggest ports in the world. Fine, we need ports like that, but we need other places that are not big ports. And so using that kind of marine spatial planning is a way that we can look at the industrial needs that we have, look at the biodiversity needs that we have, and then bring them all into context this way. So those would be my top three: marine protected areas, careful fishing, and then spatial planning.
Would you agree, Mary Sewell?
Yeah, I would have exactly the same top three, actually, I think. And it's quite good. I know that in Auckland, we're actually starting to do some of that spatial planning, which is a very nice thing to see that we're taking the step forward with respect to our local environments here.
Bob Warner.
Stole my thunder. Yeah, I'd have exactly the same three, actually in that order. And I think people are not thinking as much about zoning as they are about fishing regulations and about marine protected areas. But But we really do have to separate use and separate it intelligently. So it's not just separating out areas that we're not going to do anything in. It's separating out areas that we're going to do different things and in the ocean that will help a lot. Steve is absolutely right. One of the major differences between land animals and animals in the sea is animals in the sea have tremendous productivity. A few animals can repopulate huge areas if given the chance. And I think we just need to give them the chance.
One of the things that you've all talked about is an idea of sort of sustainable fishing. Now, if we take into context the projected population of people on the planet to exceed 9 billion, is there some way to account for that and still take on responsible, sustainable fishing? Steve Palumbi.
The number of people on the planet is a huge problem in terms of not just the number, but the energy use that people have. And so I would say that problem actually comes back to hit us not just in food needs, but in energy needs, and then the impact that that has on climate change. But no matter how many people there are on the planet, a particular fishery only has a certain sustainable level. And that's depending upon the biology of that particular fish, not our numbers. So to some extent, I think the answer to your question is that sustainable fishing is about what that fishery can sustain. It's not about our needs for it. We need to take those fisheries, add them together, all the different sustainable ones. Those are the sum total of what we have available to us. But for example, for deep sea fish, they grow very slowly. An adult deep sea fish, like a deep sea sea bass, might be 40 or 50 or even 100 years old by the time it reaches, you know, market size. If that population is replenishing itself at such a slow rate, we can only fish it sustainably at a very slow rate. And that's determined not by our desire for it, but by the biology of that species.
Steve's absolutely right that some of these species have a very, very low yield if they were to be sustainable. And why do we have so many around? Because we're not fishing them as much as we're mining them. We're extracting them and they won't come back for many, many years. And it's a much better analogy to think about these as this is unsustainable mining. It's not fishing.
It's Mary Sewell.
Something we haven't talked about yet that I think is quite important is that aquaculture, we need to feed the things that we're culturing in aquaculture with some other source of protein. And often that's another small fish that's further down the food chain. So I think that that's one of the greatest challenges we have for keeping fish on the menu is probably going to be coming up with new ways to feed the fish that we have in aquaculture settings.
Or going vegetarian. Bob Werner?
We know the lessons from the land. We've got the tools to do it differently in the ocean. And we need the will to use those tools.
And Steve Palumbi.
Like Bob said, we're in a great position now to do things differently. The oceans have an amazing collection of wildlife, more wildlife in the oceans than you can usually see on land. We all love that wildlife. We'd love our children and grandchildren to love it as well. And we want to leave a planet and an ocean that has that legacy.
Thank you, all three of you, for participating here. Steve Palumbi, Bob Werner, Mary Sewell. What a pleasure to host you. Robert Werner is a professor of marine biology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Mary Sewell is a professor of biological sciences at the University of Auckland. And Stephen Palumbi is a professor of marine sciences and director at Stanford University's Hopkins Marine Station. Palumbi is also the author of The Evolution Explosion, How Humans Cause Rapid Evolutionary Change, and The Extreme Life of the Sea. Thanks to all who made this program possible, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Cuauhtemoc Aleman, Sad Dongre, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed a part of the show, you can find our archives at scholarscircle.org. Please like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @Armudian. See you next week.